The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
I'm speaking to you from the Guardian studio in King's Place, London, but I feel a wind blowing in from the Urals. For as London Books Fair begins with the Russians as honoured guests, I bring you tales myself from the streets of Moscow. And we celebrate this historic exploit into space.
In those historic minutes when the spaceship Vostok was orbiting the Earth, with the first astronaut Yuri Gagarin on board, two-way radio contact was maintained between the Earth and the spaceship.
And also, a little nearer to us, but still in Eastern Europe, the last of our Europe weeks focuses on Poland. The novelist James Hopkin has been tramping the streets of Krakow, the setting for his latest novel.
And on this street there are many significant landmarks. There's the house where Pope John Paul II lived from 1951 to 1967. There's the Krikot Theatre that was run by Tadeusz Kantor during communist times.
James Hopkin in Poland. But now I must leave this stuffy studio too and head out into a cold Muscovite spring. I'm standing outside the, what is this library called?
The Lenin State Library, and this is the biggest one in the country.
You can see it's a big sort of Stalin era building. Mm-hmm. And it's an absolutely brilliant day. You can hear the snow melting off the roof, the plop, plop, plop of rain falling on the pavement.
Yes, we can't wait to get the spring. It's been a long, long winter here, long and steadily cold. So this is just pure bliss for us.
I'm now in the hall where the people come to collect the books, and there are various librarians sitting around reading novels, which is a rather nice touch. It's all very old-fashioned and does smell of dust and proper books, which is rather unexpected. It is, as the tour guide said, a bit like a gentleman's club with lovely old-fashioned wooden desks and lamps with green lampshades hanging over them and potted plants. It's huge, and it has at the very front of it is a huge statue of Lenin reading a book, and the lady who was translating for us said, fat lot of good it did us that he read books, but he did read books. Lenin might be a tarnished hero to some in the new Russia, but behind him in that grand reading room is a huge, heroic mural featuring the most unequivocal of Russian icons, a space rocket. And a few miles away from the library is the man who has come to personify the romance and the pride of Russian space travel, Yuri Gagarin. He towers over a square that is named after him, like Superman on a pedestal.
Товарищ Гагарин сообщал на землю о том, как он себя чувствует.
In those historic minutes when the spaceship Vostok was orbiting the Earth, with the first astronaut Yuri Gagarin on board, two-way radio contact was maintained between the Earth and the spaceship. Yuri Gagarin reported back to Earth how he was feeling and how the flight was going on. I see the Earth. Visibility good. I hear you perfectly. And sometime later, the flight is continuing well. I see the Earth. Visibility good. One can see everything.
Gagarin would barely recognise the Moscow that has sprung up since his death, with its retro cafes, its shopping malls and its gleaming new churches. So what does he mean to the young Russians of the post-Soviet era?
I think Gagarin is close to an idea of what the victory of 1945 was for the Russian most glorious event in our latest history. now Gagarin is the only thing that unites all these people that are fighting against each other, all these people that think that the only thing that unites all Russian is maybe football, of patriotism, of such kind. They all understand that Gagarin for them is the embodiment of Russian success.
That's Lev Danielkin, Moscow's most revered and feared literary critic, who'll be at the London Book Fair next week in his other capacity. He's the author of a new book about, you guessed it, Yuri Gagarin. So far, so space age. But what could this possibly have to do with that wedding cake of a library back in Moscow? Well, Danielkin is not the only Russian writer who is in London this coming week. The country is presenting a wealth of new talent as guest of honour at the London Book Fair. Among them are spy novelists and crime writers, and a new generation of science fiction writers. When I went to Moscow to meet some of these writers last month, it was the science fiction that seemed most vibrant. But it soon became clear that the term science fiction doesn't mean quite the same thing in Russia as it does in the UK. Where we trace it back to Mary Shelley and H.G. Wells, they trace it back to Bulgakov and Gorky. But surely they're satirists, I said. No, replied one leading publisher. They were the first writers to insert fantasy into realist narrative. And now here's where the narrative gets really surreal. The granddaddy of Russian science fiction was a humble librarian who spent most of his working life in that very wedding cake of a house with its back to the Kremlin. Nikolai Fedorov was born in 1829. He was a mystical bibliophile who believed the souls of humanity were enshrined in the books they had written, and that they would inevitably, at some point, be resurrected. He was also a practical man, whose daily exposure to the thousands of souls in the library convinced him that the Earth wouldn't be big enough to hold them all in their resurrected form. There was only one solution. As he wrote, "Begotten of the tiny Earth, the observer of immeasurable space, the observer of the worlds of this space, must become their inhabitant and ruler." In other words, there was only one way forward, to infinity and beyond.
He had very curious ideas that really was the source of inspiration for several generations of artists, engineers. He believed that we shouldn't miss the wisdom that is gone with the people who are dead. So he invented the project of how to resurrect them. After that, he collided with the practical consequences of this, where to place all them. When you will resurrect so many people, they had to live somewhere. That led him to the idea of conquering the space. And one of his apprentices was Konstantin Eduardovich Tsiolkovsky, that is called the father of the Soviet space program. He was the man who proposed the idea of the rocket. The shape of rocket was proposed by Tsiolkovsky, not by Werner von Braun. When you talk about Gagarin and the idea of Gagarin, you could find the very deep roots in not just in the Soviet engineering. The phenomenon of Gagarin and the Russian space program was not an accidental success. It is based on very deep philosophical tradition, and Fedorov and Tsiolkovsky were its founders.
One of the projects that will be showcased at the London Book Fair next week is an anthology of work by Russia's very youngest writers, winners of the Debut Prize, which was set up by Andrei Skok, the richest member of the Russian Parliament, the Duma, in an attempt to give a voice to the new Russia. It features all kinds of fantasy and science fiction among the realist narratives. Danielkin's book on Gagarin attempts to sketch out the cultural context for this futuristic exuberance. His book is collaged almost entirely from found texts, newspaper reports, eyewitness accounts, and fictional representations of Yuri Gagarin's life. Here's his account of Yuri's visit to Buckingham Palace 50 years ago this July.
This was the Soviet moment. It lasted from the launch of Sputnik in 1957 through Yuri Gagarin's first space flight in 1961, and dissipated along with the fear in the couple of years following the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962.
Thousands lined the 14-mile route into London for a look at the world's first cosmonaut, They cheered and chanted Gagarin as his motorcade swept by. Standing in an open silver Rolls-Royce with a specially issued license plate, YG1, Yuri waved and grinned.
Major Gagarin won over the crowds from the moment yesterday afternoon when he walked jauntily across the red carpet at Earl's Court, holding a bunch of gladioli. The crowds chanted, "Yuri, Yuri!" The major smiled disarmingly, and one woman, delighted to find a touch of human fallibility in the hero of space, cried out, "He's cut himself shaving!"
An 11-year-old Cockney boy dressed in a spacesuit waited for him outside the Soviet embassy during a stop-off in the afternoon. When the Russian asked the boy's name, the lad answered, "I'd better not say. You see, I played truant from school to get here." Laughing, Gagarin signed the boy's autograph book.
When I wrote the novel What a Carve-Up, I needed to find some event that was important for a boy born in the early 1950s. And it seemed to me that the most obvious thing was to make his hero Gagarin.
You may recognise the words of Jonathan Coe there in the final quotation from Lev Danielkin's Space Hero collage. Suffice it to say that the Queen has always got a better deal than her younger sister. She sat next to Gagarin at a royal banquet, advised him on what order to use the cutlery, and when, at the end of the meal, Yuri picked a lemon out of his water glass and ate it, she immediately followed suit, smiled and said, "Delicious." That's Yuri Gagarin's account of the banquet anyway. In the opinion of Time magazine, by the week's end, the spaceman's boyish smile and unfailing modesty had conquered all of Britain. One can only hope that the new generation of Russian writers, who have grown up bathed in the cosmic afterglow of Yuri Gagarin, will have a similar success at the London Book Fair. I'm joined now by our newly returned Moscow correspondent, Luke Harding. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you.
Can I ask you, where did you jump or were you pushed?
I was pushed rather violently in the small of the back. And so, I was expelled from Russia.
So you've returned to do things like write a neat little WikiLeaks book and that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, I did a quickie book on WikiLeaks, and I'm now writing another book on Russia.
Now, tell me, what do you think about the Russian view of themselves, as opposed to how you might view them as a foreign correspondent? They see themselves as a literary nation, a nation of soul.
I mean, I think they did. I think there's been a bit of a falling off in terms of the sort of Soviet literary and artistic culture, partly because of resourcing, partly because the 90s were very tough for a lot of people. A lot of creative people had to go and make money and join businesses and things like that. But I think what's interesting is the kind of books people are reading now. There was almost a sort of collective sigh of relief in the 90s where these sort of Soviet pupils who had to read the sort of classics could stop reading them. But into this niche, you've seen a sort of flowering of a whole load of other contemporary Russian writers. I'm thinking of people like Boris Akunin, who writes the most marvellous detective
stories. Who, of course, is available in translation, unlike most of them.
Who is available in translation and is just fantastically brilliant and commercially successful. I mean, his books are just brilliantly readable. You get on a Russian Trans-Siberian train and people are pushing them on trolleys. So there is still interest in literature. But I think the great classics, the great Russian authors you think of are perhaps not quite as read as you might expect.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this because the thing that kept coming up during my stay was they kept referring to Bulgakov and Gorky and not at all to Tolstoy. Is that a general thing?
It's very interesting, very indicative. I mean, I met a bunch of kids from a secondary school and asked them what they were reading in their kind of literature lessons. And Bulgakov, they quite like, but Tolstoy, they have to read. They read War and Peace age sort of 14 or 15. And, you know, so the thinking goes, the girls like the love scenes and the boys like the battles. But actually it turned out that no one was fantastically keen on him. What I found quite astonishing is this is the centenary of his death. So if Tolstoy were British, you know, we'd be wearing Tolstoy T-shirts. But in Russia, there's been a total silence from the state, from the Kremlin, from official Russia. I mean, Putin and Medvedev have said nothing on Tolstoy, as far as I know. The problem is they don't know what to do with him. I mean, here's this guy who was slung out of the Orthodox Church, who challenged authority, who challenged the state. And this doesn't fit with the kind of Putin model of how society should be. So what they've done is they've ignored poor old Tolstoy. He's scarcely got a look in this year.
There are hardly any modern Russian novels, you know, in your local Waterstones, if you're lucky enough to have one.
That's definitely true. Last summer, I was in an art centre in Aberystwyth, of all places, and I picked up a copy of Olga Slavnikova, who won the Russian Booker Prize in 2006 with this marvellous novel called 2017. And it's a rather dense, rather lyrical novel, and which had been brilliantly translated. But I have to say, it's one of the very few I've found that you can actually get in English. And it had appeared 5 years later, so there's obviously quite a big time lag. I think it's a great shame because there's a lot of good stuff being written, but for non-Russian speakers, it's just not accessible. And I think there's a big problem there, and I think we need more translation.
Just tell me a little bit about Stasnikova's novel, because it's got a futuristic element to it, doesn't it?
It does. This kind of futuristic dystopian genre. It seems to be exactly where we are with contemporary Russian fiction. I mean, she's from Yekaterinburg in the Urals, and it's this marvellous novel where the division between rich and poor, which is very stark already in Russia, is even more extreme. So you have the rich driving around in Porsches, breathing air, especially imported from Switzerland. And then you have the poor, sort of still in these kind of dingy Brezhnev-era apartments. And it's this sort of dark journey into the soul following an obsessional gem collector who goes deeper and deeper into the mountains. It's fantasy, but it's also very much about Putin's Russia and the kind of society he's created after 11, 12 years in power, where you have an elite who are stupendously wealthy, I mean, more wealthy than anybody in Europe. And then you have a kind of underclass who don't live in poverty but live in near poverty, and it's just a strange kind of cosmology. It's a strange universe, but a lot of other writers are doing that too. I was thinking of Dmitry Glukhovsky, who's also written a dystopian novel called Metro 2033, which is very successful. And interestingly, the way he did it was he published his novel on the internet. First of all, he started off on the internet, and then he invited readers to comment as he was writing it, so he kind of took on board some of their suggestions, and that's been a stunning success. He's sold 500,000 copies.
I was also very struck by the fact a lot of the stuff I read in translation when I went to Moscow, they go in for this thing that you see in Tolstoy of big slabs of philosophy, which doesn't necessarily translate very well. I was really interested in that's still going out. Suddenly they break out of the narrative to give their thoughts on the universe. Is that something that's universal, or did it just happen to be in the pieces
well,
I read?
Well, I think it depends on what you read. Obviously, if you read Boris Akunin, there's no Olympian philosophizing at all. There's just this kind of, if you look at the Erast van Doren series, if you look at The Winter Queen, which is my favorite Boris Akunin novel, there's just an extraordinary kind of Anglo-Japanese Russian James Bond character who goes around solving various czarist crimes and mysteries. And to be honest, I think this is what most Russians prefer to read.
Yeah, maybe a bit of a disjunction there. Now, is there a big body of emigrant literature from Russia?
There's an enormous body of emigrant literature. I mean, I'd read all the sort of classics when I came there, but what I hadn't appreciated was, for example, writers like Doblatov, how many good writers there were who left the Soviet Union in the sort of 70s and 80s, settled in the US, and were writing stupendously good fiction, short stories, novels. But they got a bit of an outing in The New Yorker, but never found a kind of, a bigger Anglophone audience. This is the thing that I constantly came up against, because the languages are so different. It's not like French or like German. It's a whole league further on that sometimes bridging that divide is quite hard.
Now, I gather you're working on a book about your experiences in Russia or about Russia. Can you give us any clues as to what it's going to be like?
Well, I can do somewhat reluctantly. Basically, I'm working on, it's a mixture of memoir and, I guess, sort of reportage from my time there. But I guess it's a kind of spy thriller. It's about the very sinister experience that I had and my family had, being harassed and tormented almost by the Russian security services, who from very early on made it clear that they didn't like me and did all sorts of scarcely believable things, including breaking into my flat, my office, and placing alarms that went off in the middle of the night that we could never locate, opening windows. They even left a sex manual.
It's sort of John le Carré stuff.
It's like John le Carré, but unfortunately it's real. He even left a sex manual by my bed. I don't know whether it was to encourage me or suggest that I was doing things wrong, but with a bookmark helpfully put on the page advising you how to have a correct orgasm. Really weird, spooky KGB stuff. And so my book, in a sense, is trying to make sense of this and talking to, for example, people from the Stasi who used the same methods in the 70s and 80s in Honecker's East Germany, about why they did this, about operational psychology, about how they would try and spook and frighten opponents. So I'm trying to go beyond Le Carré into actually what they're doing now. I mean, we'll think the Cold War is over, but I very much had the sense, as someone who's just been expelled from Russia, that the Russian elite almost feel that it's Cold War round two, but this time they're going to win. They're not going to lose.
It's interesting because Lev Danielkin said to me, oh, we don't write spy novels so much because actually you couldn't equal reality. And maybe it takes somebody from outside the culture to actually reflect that reality. They're all having to look elsewhere.
It's no secret to say that it is a spy state. I mean, people from the former KGB, including Putin himself, occupy very much the top offices of state. And one thing I came up against was their extraordinary powers of fantasy. I mean, they had decided that I was the head of MI6 and, you know, maybe the queen as well, I don't know. But the spy mania, which was a phenomenon of the Cold War, is absolutely alive and thriving. And underneath all of this, I think, is a fear that the current elite might lose power. And they really want to hang on to power at all costs.
Luke, thank you very much and very good luck with your book. I hope the manuscript doesn't mysteriously disappear from your hard drive.
I have had that thought. Yeah.
I've gone on about science fiction in Russia, but if you were to ask a Pole, they would tell you that, of course, they got there first. As far back as the late 18th century, Mikhail Dmitry Krajewski wrote a novel about the lunar adventures of a fellow Pole. They also have Stanislav Lem, who wrote the much-filmed Solaris, and who, it has been said, is the most widely read SF writer in the world. The English novelist James Hopkin spent a lot of time in Poland over the last 10 years, and even set a novel in his favourite city of Krakow. So we asked him to pick up a sound recorder for the very first time and paint us a sound portrait of this very literary city.
Krakow, which other city composed a Pope and two Nobel Prize winners for literature in the last 35 years? There was Czesław Miłosz in 1980 and Wisława Szymborska in 1996. But the city is also home to the science fiction writer Stanisław Lem and the dramatist and short story writer Zławomir Mrożek, as well as the underground poet and enfant terrible of the Polish literary scene, Marcin Świetlicki. But there's also another significant name here, Józef Teodor Konrad Korzeniowski, who lived here as a child for several years. So now I'm outside the house where Konrad lived for a few childhood years until 1869. And I'm with Grzegorz, who's one of the directors of the Konrad Festival. And why is Konrad still important to Krakow and Krakow?
Hello. He's not only important for Krakow, he's important for Polish and international literature. The festival, it's just a festival named after him. Why? Because the festival includes international writers. And of course, Konrad is probably the best known Polish writer writing in English and published his novels abroad.
And how is he regarded within Polish literature by Polish people? Do they still take him as a Polish writer or as something of a renegade for writing in English?
No, I wouldn't say that he's treated as a renegade, not at all. But you know, for a long time, he was, after the Second World War, especially in 80s, 17 and 80s, he was important for people who were looking for some moral options, also political options. It was exactly the same before the Second World War. But after that, after 1989, Konrad disappeared. Now, thanks to the post-colonial studies, Konrad is being discussed, his work is being discussed in Poland, but I think that we still have to do more to bring him back from mm-hmm. the archives.
I'm making my way across the square, past the long yellow cloth wall in the centre, the 14th century Sukiennica, recently renovated and reopened. And I'm passing the monument to Poland's most famous romantic poet, Adam Mickiewicz, who wrote the national classic, Pan Tadeusz. I'm heading to Empik, a nationwide department store, to see what the people of Poland are reading at the moment. And Shimon, what can you tell me about them?
Number one is Jan Thomas Gross, Golden Harvest. That's a book that came out first in English, written by a Polish sociologist and a historian. That's a book about what was happening in Poland right after World War II. Jan Thomas Gross is widely known for his first publication, namely The Neighbors, which was a controversial title, and Golden Harvest is such as well.
So is it, to some extent, a discussion of anti-Semitism in Poland?
To some extent, it's not really.
It's just someone in the background saying no to this book and giving us the thumbs down.
The rest of the top 10.
Let's see, we have the usual vampire romance.
There's and Eric Emanuel Schmidt,
who's always very popular in
Hugely popular in Poland.
I'm surprised not to see Paulo Coelho, who's also huge in Poland.
Eric Emanuel Schmidt took over his place, basically. It's the same type of literature, so yeah. I guess people switched over to him. And then there is Beata Pawlikowska, Blondynka na Języka. She's a...
coming in at number seven.
A Polish journalist who writes lighter travelogues. And journalism is something, and travel writing is something that's been picking up recently in Poland, and she's one of the stars of the movement, writing the lighter, just travel the globe. But this is about, this particular one is about UK. Then we have Leonie Swan.
Triumph of Yates.
The Triumph of the Sheep. It is down into a radio play at the moment, so that's probably why it is so widely popular. And at number 10, Janusz Leon Wiśniewski. He writes like, I guess, most female writers would like to write.
Institut Chomsky, the Books Institute. That's what I'm looking for now as I enter this amazing 18th century townhouse with extraordinary stained glass windows depicting religious scenes by its old wooden staircase, which I'm about to embark on now. It's a long and winding wooden staircase, and I'm just passing a sign for Restauracja Podgruszka, the restaurant beneath the sign of the pear. It's like entering a scenario by Bruno Schulz. And I'm walking up here to the Books Institute to speak to Szymon Kloska about Polish literature in translation around Europe, what's available now to read from Polish books in English.
What happens is we basically do two things. Namely, we try to promote Polish literature abroad, and we try to promote readership within boundaries of Poland. And we do it through our book fair catalogs that are coming out twice a year, new books from Poland. The most interesting titles, together with excerpts from them and critics' commentary. But we also are trying to be in touch with translators. We have hosted twice already World Congress of Polish Literature Translators, and both times there were over 400 translators from all over the globe present. And our main instrument of keeping in touch with the publishers and the translators is Copyright Poland Translation Program. Through that, any publisher can apply for up to 100% costs of license and translation.
Would you say since EU accession in 2004 that there has been a growth of interest in Polish literature around Europe?
The interest started obviously in 1989, then our accession to European Union was definitely an important moment. And what is also important is that there are various genres of Polish literature that sort of haven't been too active and kind of were left out. And
would you include science fiction?
Science fiction, definitely. Crime and mystery novels, definitely.
Krajewski.
And Krajewski, which actually is doing well in UK from what we know, and another title of his is coming out. Also, young literature, things like Masłowska, Kuczak, Witkowski. With the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, you can observe that the literary life is getting a new and more organized shape. So there is awards, there is a means of and instruments of promotion that are not
more only of a literary infrastructure.
Yeah, definitely. And so that sort of helps out a bit as well.
So now I'm on Kamieniczna Street, one of the loveliest streets in Krakow that leads down to the Wawel Castle. It's a beautiful sunny morning in early April, And on this street there are many significant landmarks. There's the house where Pope John Paul II lived from 1951 to 1967. There's the Krikot Theatre that was run by Tadeusz Kantor during communist times and was known for its subversive, very avant-garde theatre productions, often moving them during performance so that they wouldn't be closed down to some other cellar in the city, some unspecified and secret location known only to the audience and cast. Now to the cellar of the Kavania Literacka, the literary cafe, where Krakowian writers have been meeting for decades. And I'm heading down the steps to the cellar to meet Grzegorz Jankowski again, this time to talk to him as one of the directors of Ha Art Korporacja that was set up 10 years ago as an important independent publishing house.
It was created as a journal called Ha Art, a magazine devoted to young Polish literature, poetry, prose, essay writings, philosophy, art. After 1 or 2 years, the founders decided to organize a huge festival. Before that, they started to publish books of poetry. Uh-huh. One of them was a book of poetry by Marcin Cecko, for example. Uh-huh. Marcin Ożuk also published the book. So after that, Piotr Marecki and Jan Sowa created a foundation. And that was the moment when the institution actually was set up. Hard corporation. And the word corporation, of course, is used in a very ironic way because we are not a like corporation mm-hmm. at all.
You've gone more and more into publishing novels,
exactly.
poetry. And does that make you one of the strongest independent publishers in Poland or certainly in Kraków?
It's very leftist. And at the moment when it was created, it was not so common that young people would create the institution of that kind. Uh-huh. Later, there was another institution, very, very good and interesting institution created in Warsaw, which is Krytyka Polityczna.
So who, in writing terms, are you publishing who's exciting and dynamic at the moment?
We've published the first book by Sławomir Sierakow, by Sławomir Schuty. Uh-huh. The first...
He's a writer from Nowa Huta.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The district on the edge of Kraków.
Exactly.
Famous for
exactly.
its steelworks during exactly. communist times.
Yes. We've published Michał Witkowski. Mm-hmm. Lubiewo was,
yeah,
was
he's
first.
Translated into English as Love Town.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Sylwia Hutnik.
An Atlas for Women?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes. All of them are very popular and eminent writers now. So that was in the past. Now we are still working with young writers. We are still looking for the new voices in Polish literature, which is not that easy, actually. Mm-hmm. I think that we still have to wait to think about them as a generation.
So are there one or two names of writers born in the 90s?
Ozarowska is a name. We published her her book In Heart, The Thunder Bride Will Never Strike,
uh-huh.
which is a figure of speech that she uses to describe the expectations of her generation.
Uh-huh.
They do not believe that there will be any political or social or existential abrupt change mm-hmm. that would cause them to think about the world in a different way. I remember the meeting with young people from secondary school. They said that it's a pure description of their generation.
Mm-hmm.
Dożarowska got it all right.
In the background, you can hear the hourly trumpet from one of the towers of St. Mary's Church, the Hainel, as it's called. I first came to Kraków in 1998, and then again in 2000 to interview Wisława Szymborska for The Guardian, as well as Andrzej Staszuk, Olga Tokarczuk, and Tadeusz Rozewicz, a very fine poet who will be 90 this year. Back then, I decided I'd like to return to the city to write my first novel, which I subsequently did. Such is the beauty of Kraków and its reverence for books and writers, that each time I return, it feels a little like my hometown. Perhaps this is what it means to feel European.
And of course, we can't leave Poland without a quick trip around our world literature tour. Lindsay Irving joins me from the Guardian Books Desk. Lindsay, Poland's a nation of poets, isn't it? We've got quite a few here.
Yes, indeed. Grace Andriachi, first of all, suggests Czesław Miłosz and his new and collected poems. We'll be hearing a lot more from Miłosz in this centenary year of his birth. Indeed, a little bird has told us that Stephen Fry was even going to condescend to read some of his non-rhyming poetry.
And record it, actually, so I gather, but maybe we shouldn't have revealed that. What more have we got?
Zimborska is also recommended, new and collected poems by Cloud22, who says Zimborska's poems are carefully crafted, philosophical, playful, witty, and sublime. Using everyday imagery and making unexpected connections, she explores the big questions of life, death, and what it means to be human.
And we've got Zygmunt Herbert, but not for poetry, although he's best known as a poet, isn't he? It's for an essay collection, Lindsay.
That's right. Barbarian in the Garden is suggested by Nip Fuhr. It is, as you say, not a poetry collection, but essays describing a journey he took as a young man through Greece, France, and Italy. Nip Fuhr says it offers shrewd observations from the viewpoint of a barbarian with respect to classical European culture, though he's obviously anything but.
And talking of barbarians, we've also got two mentions for James Hopkins' Winder Underwater. Those are from Jay Howard and Benjamin. And James, if you're listening, which I'm sure you are, you can't have two mums, so we have to assume that you do have lots of fans for your take on Polishness. We never doubted it. And there's a tip for Stanislaw Lem, of course, not for Solaris, but for the Futurological Congress, of which Tiojo says, you can read it in many ways, as an absurd, amusing futurist science fiction, as philosophy or as satire. There are many layers, but you have to dig deep and remember the time in which it was written and when its author lived. And that's all from us for this week. Lindsay, will you take us through some of the things we've got coming up?
Yes, indeed. This coming weekend belongs to David Foster Wallace, and we're paying tribute in grand style. We're running his editor's account of putting his posthumous novel, The Pale King, together after his death, and there's an extract from that in Saturday Review. On Sunday in The Observer, New Review has an interview with his widow.
And look out for Seamus Heaney's centenary tribute to Miwosh if you haven't already seen it. It's up on our website. Thanks very much to all of you who've helped us with our month-long tour of four European countries. We've had many highlights. Among them for me was the nonagenarian French diplomat who's become surprise bestseller in France. There's hope for all of us, Lindsay. More for me than for you. You're going to have to wait longer. And don't forget to catch up with any of our shows that you've missed by going to guardian.co.uk/books and clicking on the Books podcast tab. And do become a regular subscriber. My thanks today to Luke Harding, to James Hopkin in Poland, to Lindsay Irving here in the studio, and to our producer, Tim Mabey. I'm Claire Armistead. For now, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.